We acknowledge that we are on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' spirit, imagination, and rich history of storytelling and humour that is an inspiration for all Australians.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of The Bearer of Weird News. As always, I am your host and the suppository of all wisdom, Matt Harvey. I'm back, guys. I'm back from Edinburgh, and I'd just like to thank you all once again for tuning in for another episode of The Bearer of Weird News. But before I can bear said weird news, I need to take the time to thank some of our sponsors. Starting, of course, with you, the wonderful people of the Patreon. All I can say is that everything that follows is because of you, and your, we'll call it, reckless encouragement of the things that I am doing. I wouldn't be able to call so many people cunts without your help. So I'd just genuinely like to thank you for that. It is a joy that I get to partake in because of you. But you couldn't possibly have done it alone. As you already know, you couldn't possibly have done it alone. That would be much too large a Sisyphean task to take on. That even the Greek gods would think it too futile to force you into that state of existence. So, I do need to thank some of our larger sponsors. So, if you could just take a moment as we go over to Capitalism Corner and thank our major sponsor for this episode, which is International Day of Listening, which is actually almost the perfect sponsor for a podcast, really, as listening is what you do to make all of this possible. Unless, of course, you're watching the video version of this online with the sound down and you're reading the subtitles, then I guess you'll just have to wait until International Day of Reading in order to get the thanks that you deserve. So just be patient. Oh, suddenly you don't know how to read between the lines, Mr. I Love to Read? Just calm down. Today isn't for you. We'll get to you. And as this is International Day of Listening, we wanted to do something special for you. Our listeners. Very good. You spend so much time listening to me. Well, I wanted to complete the parasocial relationship by spending some time listening to you with our new Bearer of Weird News Parasocial Relationship Listening Kit for only one small monthly payment of varying amounts depending on how desperate you are feeling that month. And believe us, Google will tell us how desperate you are. You will receive a series of responses that you can play as you speak about the news, weird or otherwise, in your life. Did you just get promoted? Great! Just put in our congratulatory parasocial kit, which includes sounds like, uh-huh, oh wow, and that's amazing. And of course, the classic congratulations in a series of varying intonations and levels of enthusiasm for you to adjust according to the level of celebration that you require. And of course, we will be releasing the conversation kits in monthly bundles. So if something terrible happens between now and next month when our next bundle releases, you can get yourself ready to vent, as our next bundle will be the Unwavering Support Bundle, where you'll receive such classic statements of unwavering support as, I'm so sorry to hear that. You did tell them that months, stroke weeks, stroke days, stroke years ago. Of course, you'll need to delete those as per your needs in the moment. And the classic, what a cunt. All of these do come with adjustable levels of malice to match the conversation that you need unwavering support on. So to start you off, we are giving away the very first sample for free right now with the following complimentary phrases. I'm sure the party will go swimmingly. And at the very least, we didn't have to invite that insert name of terrible workplace rival. They wouldn't know how to have fun, even if someone did remove the stick from their ass and a rainbow started shining out of it. Dinner was delightful, and I look forward to an evening free of crippling diarrhea. And what was possibly our most requested statement to date? Well, who leaves a frog in the middle of the road just like that anyway? And to begin with, here is a sample of some room tone that you can put under my audio and in between the words that I say to make it feel like I'm genuinely in the room with you and not just subtly appearing out of nowhere. And begin. Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I didn't think my lunch would come back so quickly. And look, here's the thing. If you need a replacement room tone sound, you can just reach out to our sponsor, International Day of Listening, with the code word HA, so that they know that we sent you. And of course, this, all of this would not be possible without my live shows. So to start, I'd just like to say a huge thanks to those who came out to my live shows in Edinburgh. I think I did something like 50 shows over the month, and it was a hell of an achievement. Exhausting, but massive, and I enjoyed it a lot. I had such a great time, and I'm really looking forward to my upcoming dates and to coming back and performing for you again with some new shows or some new ideas. For those of you who are looking for somewhere where you might be able to support me live, I am going to the first ever Mildura Fringe Festival on November 1st. Tickets are on sale right now, so make sure you snatch them up. And Canberra, I'll be coming to you for the Canberra Fringe Festival, but I'll be there November 22nd at the Smith's Alternative. So I am quite looking forward to those. I'm doing my stand-up and storytelling show, I Got Bit by a Monkey Once. First time in any of those places, so please do come out and support the live show. Then, I think this is maybe the biggest news that this podcast has ever dropped. I'll be bringing out a brand new show. For the first time in many years, a brand new show next year to as many festivals as I can bring it to. So make sure you listen out for that, as I will start announcing dates and festivals in the coming months as we lock them in. But until then, guys, until then, I will be the bearer of weird news. So let's start now with the headlines. To prevent transgender participants in women's sports, Donald Trump said athletes hoping to compete in the 2028 Olympic and Paralympic Games in Los Angeles will be subjected to a very, very strong form of testing. He wanted to say that he is willing to go into the women's change room and personally check all the women himself. And you might think that as president, he doesn't have time for that. But I would like to remind you that just recently he had so little going on, people actually thought he was dead. So I'm pretty sure he can find the time. A grand jury has declined to indict a man who was charged with felony assault after he threw a sandwich at a federal officer in Washington, D.C. Now, if we're going to punish people for handing out questionable sandwiches, then I'd like to take up a case against my local 7-Eleven, please. I'm pretty sure what they are presenting as sandwiches are less sandwiches and more of a hate crime. Nestle's CEO has been dismissed by the company over what they called an undisclosed romantic relationship with a direct subordinate, which breached Nestle's code of business conduct. The company went on to say that if the CEO really wanted to keep his job, then next time he'd have to do something less damaging to the company, like, just as a random example, publicly declare water isn't a human right. Then he could continue to work in the job for as long as he liked. Delta Airlines and United Airlines have been sued by passengers who claim that they were charged extra for a window seat but found themselves sitting next to a blank wall. Both Delta and United have been offered the opportunity to go to court and lie to the judge about exactly why they charged for services they knew they weren't going to provide. Out of habit, the airlines then attempted to charge the suing customers a fee for appearing in court, a fee for being sued, and of course, a fee for coming up with new fees to charge you. Because you know the motto of all airlines, we're going to have to charge you a fee for that. Police have recorded more than 80 counterfeit cash incidents in Canberra since December last year. offenders have been using fake $50 or $100 notes to purchase smaller items, receiving the balance in legitimate cash. ACT police say the fake notes have some indicators to look out for, such as images being off, no code numbers, shimmers or shines, and this is not actually even a joke. Some of them actually had the words copy or prop written on them. And some of the notes, if you look really closely, and to be fair, it was very subtle, actually had the word Monopoly written on top of them. A military court found a New Zealand soldier guilty of attempted espionage after they admitted to offering military base maps and photographs to a foreign nation in the first spying conviction in New Zealand's history. Well, the second, if we count an attempted selling out of New Zealand by Saruman the White to the Dark Lord in the Third Age. But we don't tend to count anything that happened before modern colonisation, so... Data analytics show the number of people in the UK visiting porn sites has decreased sharply since enhanced age verification rules came into place, with visits falling from 3.2 million to 2 million. That story again, the search for VPNs in the UK has spiked 1,800% after age verification laws started in the UK for popular porn sites. Or, so I'm told. I wouldn't know anything about that sort of thing. I certainly haven't spent the last month in the UK. A zoo in Denmark has appealed to the public to donate their healthy, unwanted pets as part of a unique effort to provide food for its predators, as they have a responsibility to imitate the natural food chain of animals. If it doesn't work out, they can just return to their original plan of matching with men who have hunting photos in their dating profile and then inviting them to a date at the zoo. Toilets stopped working on a Virgin Australia flight from Bali, according to a passenger who said that the crew told him to urinate in a bottle. Now, making passengers piss in a bottle is a weird way to announce that you have a new partnership with Amazon, but I understand that brand stability is important and you really need to stick what the people know best. Documents released under the Official Information Act show New Zealand's Regulation Minister and Deputy Prime Minister David Seymour sought advice on ditching bike helmet rules. This is a really weird, like, 5D chess maneuver, because they know that trying to gerrymander a district will actually get them in trouble. But if they go out of their way to, say, gerrymander the public's brain cells, nobody will ever see it coming. FIFA is considering holding a World Cup every 2 years from 2029. Because apparently one bribe every 4 years isn't nearly enough bribes to keep an organisation flush with cash. And they really need to find more opportunities for maximising bribes in the future. And that's it for the headlines today. We're going to move on to the larger stories, starting with Palestine news. Amid mounting international pressure on Israel to end its everlasting genocidal shitshow in Gaza, there is growing diplomatic momentum in the West to recognize Palestinian statehood. At this point, it is almost certain that the UK, France, Canada, Belgium and Malta will recognise Palestinian statehood at a UN conference later this month, to be held on the sidelines of the General Assembly. And in a surprise move, jumping from the top rope like a villain attempting to become a hero and provide Palestine with an unexpected assist, the Australian government has pledged to recognise the Palestinian state. Yeah, Anthony Albanese said a two-state solution was the best hope to bring an end to the conflict, suffering, and starvation in Gaza. And this is both a big deal and absolutely nothing at all. You see, it's a big deal because Australia, you might know, historically has had some experience in the area of ethnic cleansing followed by a bit of sheep grazing, especially in Tasmania. Look it up if you're not sure what I'm talking about. But it is also a big old bag of nothing. it's as impactful as a political cartoon in stopping anything from happening. It's basically the political equivalent of posting a cartoon to Instagram. Symbolic, moving, maybe, but guaranteed not to stop a single bomb from dropping. It's a symbolic act, which, to be fair, we are very good at. It is so much easier to be symbolic than it is to take genuine action, and I think we prefer it that way. See, claiming we'll recognise Palestine without sanctioning Israel is the global politics version of doing an acknowledgement of country. We do recognise your existence, but don't expect us to stop bombing your homes. But we will recognise them. You're welcome. But at least we aren't laying down conditions for statehood.
But Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says Australia's recognition comes with conditions.
Oh, Albo, what are you doing? Why are we laying down conditions? What possible conditions could we... I mean, we're off to a very bad start here. I don't love us putting conditions on the existence of a country that existed before we dumped another country on top of them. Like, just, that feels like really bad form. Especially when it is recognised by 147 of the UN's 193 member states. I mean, look at some of the countries that recognise Palestine. South Africa, China, North Korea, even Russia. And Russia is actively trying to delete another country from the map as we speak, but still thinks that Palestine deserves unconditional recognition. When Vladimir "Delete Ukraine" Putin looks more progressive than you do on sovereignty, you may need to rethink your brand of support. Now, I will grant you that the decision for Australia to recognise Palestine is predicated on commitments from the Palestinian Authority's Mohammed Abbas, who said his group will undergo critical governance reforms and that a future state will have no reform for members from Hamas. And Abbas has already made pledges, including a demilitarized Palestine, recognizing Israel's right to exist in peace and security, the Palestinian Authority holding elections and undertaking governance reforms, including education system reforms and not promoting further violence, plus, most importantly, I guess, no role for Hamas. But it's not just us imposing restrictions on the Palestinian statehood. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's pledge was also predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to reforms and elections, including no role for Hamas and a demilitarized Palestine, which sounds kind of familiar. The French President Emmanuel Macron noted Abbas's condemnation of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority's calls for Hamas to be disarmed and excluded from future governance of Palestine, so that's nice. And British Prime Minister Keir Starmer pledged to recognise Palestine unless... Hang on. Unless... I mean, what are you doing, Keir? What unless? I mean, that sounds worse than just putting simple conditions. Go on, Keir. What is this unless of yours, huh?
So today, as part of this process towards peace, I can confirm the UK will recognise the State of Palestine by the United Nations General Assembly in September unless the Israeli government takes substantive steps to end the appalling situation in Gaza, agree to a ceasefire, and commit to a long-term sustainable peace, reviving the prospect of a two-state solution.
Right. So let me get this straight. The UK will do what the UN says all countries should do under international law, but only if Israel keeps committing to committing genocide. But if Israel goes back to stopping committing genocide and simply goes back to oppressing the old-fashioned way, what will happen then? The UK will not recognize Palestine? Finally, a solution we can all believe in. So if they go back to the old school oppression, so checkpoints, blockages, a light sprinkling of apartheid, then Palestine doesn't count as Palestine anymore. It's just Israel that's yet to realize that it's Israel. Now, look, I'm being unfair. I think you're banging on there a bit, Kia, but you might not have gone ineffectual enough. We might have to bring in the big guns to be really ineffectual with our recognition of the Palestinian state. So I think we may have to force Israelis to do an acknowledgement of country before they commit a genocide, starve a child, or blow up a hospital, or a wedding, or a school. That will teach them how to properly respect the land which they are stealing. So what's that going to look like? We recognize the deep cultural heritage of the maternity ward. Feels about right. Now it feels about the level of commitment that we've given as a global community at this point. So I feel like that's maybe where we should start. Maybe that's where we should end. Albanese and the Foreign Affairs Minister, Penny Wong, they did shrug off repeated questions about what happens if the commitments are not met. Albanese has refused multiple times to say whether Australia could revoke Palestinian recognition if, for example, the Israelis don't take to our brand new acknowledgement of country plan. But you know who doesn't have those kinds of reservations? Our old mates, your friends and mine, the Coalition, who have proudly announced that they would revoke recognition of a Palestinian state if elected. It's just nice to see some standard practices and behaviour from a major political party in what could be the most unnecessary statement in the history of Australian politics. Susan Ley said, "The Coalition would never have made this call, and we do not agree with it. A coalition government would only recognise a Palestinian state at the conclusion of a proper peace process." Seems the LNP have taken the title of opposition to its inevitable logical conclusion. That being to consistently do the exact opposite of Labour, even if it costs them the next election, which like isn't the worst thing for us as a country, but it is kind of strange that they are so committed to this terrible practice. Like, I know we use the word opposition, but being in opposition is more than saying no when the government says yes. Sometimes you actually have to have slightly different ideas, or, you know, maybe approach a thing from a slightly different angle, you know? Instead of being at 180 degrees, you can be at 90 degrees or 45 degrees. But it is good to see Susan be consistent with the brand and style of the Coalition and show their voters that despite being the first woman ever as their leader, she is determined to fuck it up properly, just like a man would. And in a rare move, we have made a proper global impact, pissing off Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who claimed, "History will remember Albanese for what he is, a weak politician who betrayed Israel and abandoned Australia's Jews." Oof, we really made him angry. He better watch out. If he keeps running his mouth, we will stop selling him the dual-use components from at least 35 military export permits that we still have running. Sure, they'll still have the US and the UK selling them weapons and components, but they won't have as many deadly weapons to commit an unrelenting genocide with. Will they now? Yeah, they didn't think about that. Then what are they going to do? Imagine the inconvenience when they're down to only a few billion dollars worth of bombs which they could use to blow up a hospital or a school. It'll really slow down the genocide to maybe only within business hours. But in a nice little two-for-one, we actually also managed to piss off the US, as US Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee said the Australian government's decision to recognise Palestine was unfortunate and disappointing. Oh no! What are you gonna do, Mike? Take back all your shitty beef? Oh, please don't! The dogs of Australia will depend on it. They love getting real rampant bouts of diarrhea from eating American beef. Don't get me wrong, I know for decades we've marched in lockstep with US foreign policy in the Middle East, invaded more than our fair share of countries at the whim of the US president. And Trump has repeatedly accused countries that have recognized a Palestinian state of rewarding Hamas for the militant group's attack on Israel. Which is rich, because not recognizing Palestine for 75 years has been the ultimate reward for Israel's warmongering. At this point, the US has the foreign policy consistency of a toddler, rewarding bad behavior, punishing attempts at fairness, crying when their Lego tower falls over. Which is particularly strange because the coalition has accused Labour of emboldening Hamas with their two-state solution proposal, even though most countries talking about recognition are talking about it in the context of being used to remove Hamas. Remember, we said earlier, most of the countries were conditional on the removal of Hamas and them having no future position in elections. And I don't know if you were watching when we mentioned that earlier. It's a major sticking point. I can't stress it enough. Recognition is being talked about explicitly to weaken Hamas. So yes, Australia is finally, tentatively, kind of conditionally recognizing Palestine. But don't worry, in keeping with tradition, we will absolutely continue to do nothing about our own oppressed indigenous population. Let's not get any wild ideas, alright? We're not willing to change that much. Moving on now, it is immigration news. Now, while I was away, there was a series of anti-immigration rallies which were held across the nation's capitals. You might have heard about them. Maybe you showed up to counter-protest them. If you listen to this podcast, and I hope you do, there is a good chance that you did. If you don't listen to this podcast, well, maybe there's a good chance that you were at the rally that my people were counter-rallying. Or maybe you're the majority of people who don't listen to this podcast. I don't know. The rallies were called the March for Australia, which is actually very confusing branding because normally when you march for something, you're supposed to actually like the thing. This is like staging a march for broccoli because you think broccoli is disgusting and shouldn't exist. And these marches have garnered a little bit of criticism, we'll say, with some attendees saying the events had nothing at all to do with race and were in fact aimed at slowing down migration, regardless of where it was coming from. Ah, I see, the old "I'm not racist, I hate everyone" approach to public discourse. It's the same philosophy that your uncle displays at family gatherings. And that's just when he's talking about the family that's already there. But any ambiguity was cleared up at the Sydney rally, where someone brought a sign which read "White Unity at Every Opportunity," which is about as subtle and nuanced as a Ricky Gervais stand-up routine about trans people. Now, in a rare moment of decisiveness, the federal government immediately came out against the rallies, saying it stands with modern Australia. And that is a nice change of pace, as we have struggled recently with being in alignment with modern Australia for a hot minute. Not on Palestine, not on fossil fuels, not on transparency, and certainly not on koala habitats. Let's be honest, we're less girt by sea as we are girt by contradiction. The government said that Australia has no place for people who seek division. And you know how serious they were, because they busted out the big guns. Yeah, that's right. They called the marches un-Australian. Ooh! That's a sacred term, usually reserved for things like beach hogging, queue jumping, or not owning a Bunnings sausage-stained shirt. Albo might even go so far as to say that he isn't angry, he's disappointed. Which, as every child of a migrant parent knows, ooh, that is far worse. They do love to trot out the accusation of un-Australian, like it means anything to us. Although, I guess, like, to these people, the March for Australia people, I suppose it means everything, doesn't it? Because that's what the whole march was about, right? What's Australian and what's un-Australian? People were upset that some people deemed to be un-Australian were in the country. While maybe, just maybe, the reductive nature of politicians claiming from on high that members of a general populace or certain ideals don't fall within the restrictive umbrella of Australianness, while others, like destroying the natural environment and Indigenous cultural sites to maximise profits for major corporations, if anything, I mean, that should be considered un-Australian, right? Surely, that's un-Australian. But given we don't consider the destruction of Indigenous sites un-Australian, then I'm surprised we do consider a group of white people storming and violently assaulting a place called Camp Sovereignty, which is a frontline camp on top of an Indigenous burial ground, to be un-Australian. It just seems philosophically inconsistent with everything that we've lined up so far. So here, let me see if I can wrap my head around this. Let me get this straight. A bunch of white settlers at an anti-immigration rally, which was organised by a group of neo-Nazis, the leader of which is himself technically an immigrant because he is from New Zealand. Yeah, sure, he's been living here since he was about 5, but he is technically an immigrant, who then attacked Aboriginal people and destroyed a sacred site. Yeah, that actually sounds quintessentially Australian to me. That sounds like large portions of Australians' history, and I can see why these people would want to enact these behaviours, because that's the part of Australia that they really like. It's honouring the ancestors, right? And the ancient ways. I mean, if that isn't the purest distillation of Australian history, then I don't know what is. That's not un-Australian. That's heritage listed, motherfucker. They say that they want things to be how they used to be. But they're not really talking about 40,000 years ago. They're talking less than 200 years ago. And guess what, guys? Mission accomplished. White people turning up, stealing land, and attacking the locals. That is how things used to be. It's basically a colonization reenactment day. They believe one very strict idea. People shouldn't be able to just immigrate to Australia willy-nilly. No, of course not. If you want to come to Australia, you need to be sentenced here. Like, obviously, that's the only way that you're allowed to come here. And we should spend time debunking the claims that these neo-Nazis made, right? Something like more than 1,500 migrants arrive in Australia every day. Yeah, we could do that. The ABS says that these figures are not accurate. They're not an accurate reflection of actual immigration figures. So this is basically based on overseas arrivals and departures data, which counts long-term and permanent migrants as they arrive and depart through Australian borders. So some of those people are leaving. This isn't a one-way street. Or that there's been more Indian immigrants in 5 years than Greeks and Italians in 100 years. Which, when Peter MacDonald, the Emeritus Professor of Demography at the Australian National University, said, the claim is an odd statement to make, and that while Indian arrivals over the past few years have been numerically bigger, the statistic is comparable to Greek and Italian post-war arrivals, when you consider migration as a percentage of overall population. But it's all pretty wild talk, and it is a concern coming from them, but much worse when these kinds of talking points come from elected officials. People like Senator Jacinta Napajanama Price, who claimed Labor was prioritising Indian immigrants to bolster its vote, which is a pretty wild statement to make. And I just have to ask, do you know how far-fetched a plan like this would have to be? How many years it would take to come to fruition? They'd have to have come here, obtained PR, wait 4 years until applying for citizenship, apply to be a citizen, then hopefully they vote for the party that they see as supporting them, even though they weren't the ones who have brought them in. Right? Not only is that a paperwork marathon, if that's their master plan, it wouldn't pay off until sometime in 2047, right around the time that climate change turns Darwin into Atlantis. The numbers would be way too small to make any difference. And all the immigrants that voted in the 2022 election and any elections that came after that, which brought Albo into power, would have been brought in when the coalition was in power. So somehow this would have to have been a plan set in motion by the opposition to make Albo get into power so that they could speak out against him, so that they could claim that he had brought these immigrants into power, so that they could dethrone him. Do you understand the problem here? Do you see how it all starts to fall apart? AEC data shows that the vast majority of new voters this year were from people coming of age, not from gaining citizenship from immigration. There was 1,831,800 new voters aged 18 to 24, roughly 92% of the eligible population, leaving around 159,937 unregistered voters. Whereas, as of the 31st of March, 47,826 new citizens were enrolled to vote, which is less than unregistered voters aged 18 to 24. Do you see those numbers? One of them is much larger than the other. So if you really wanted to panic about demographics, it's not immigration, it's teenagers. It's horny millennials making babies. If they want to march in the streets, they should stage a rally to stop millennials from fucking. But of course, the easiest way to do that, well, give them jobs and affordable houses, because nothing kills sex faster than financial stability and open plan living. The most upsetting part of it all of these anti-immigration hypocrites are here importing their weird foreign ideologies, attempting to challenge the political landscape of Australia with their weird foreign ideologies. They have no respect for how the locals think or how they want to run the country. These guys are just going to be really embarrassed when they realise the mistake that they have made. At this point, not only have we offshored some of the most well-known Australian brands like Lean Cuisine, Speedo, CUB, Schweppes, Arnott's, Billabong, and even the iconic 420 Pie, but now we can't even make our own race-baiting conspiracies domestically? That's embarrassing. That's what that is. We've outsourced xenophobia. If we're going to be racist, we should at least be trying to make something local, something that we can proudly call our own until we sell it to a foreign market in a desperate attempt to keep our culture afloat. It's like artisan, locally made racism. You know, like Vegemite or Pauline Hanson. And finally, it is Centrelink news. You know, talking about the news, it is rare that I get to deliver good news. Because news, by its nature, is drawn towards disasters, scandals, and lists of 20 cats that look like Hitler, especially in this age of clickbait and outrage farming. So it is my genuine pleasure to announce about 3 million Australians who were affected by Centrelink's unlawful debt calculation are set to be eligible for up to $600 in compensation. A life-changing amount of money if you lived in 1983. Honestly, this wouldn't even buy a house if you were a Lego minifigure. The announcement came after the federal government admitted the use of income appropriatement to determine welfare payments was invalid. Yes, I believe their exact words were, "Hey, don't spend it all at once, because if you do, we'll just invent another calculator and take it all back from you." Income appropriatement, if you're not sure, it's the same kind of debt calculation that was used to calculate the debts that made up robo-debt, which was determined to be unlawful. But don't worry, they've upgraded. Instead of fake maths, they're using, wait for it, genuine fucking maths. It's revolutionary. Forget AI and quantum computing or blockchain. The future is numbers being used correctly by a person. Next year, they might even trial basic human empathy, although Treasury has costed that at $47 billion over 4 years, so don't hold your breath. The Social Services Minister, Tanya Plibersek, announced the government would also raise the threshold for small accidental deaths for the first time in 30 years, which is also very exciting. It's like getting some sprinkles on top of your ice cream, you know? If they keep this up, then we'll become accustomed to receiving treats. And what's the word? Basic human dignity. Oh, man, which, like, basic human dignity hasn't been raised for longer than 30 years, so, like, we're being spoiled this month. Alright, so what's new? What's the threshold? What's the new threshold? It must be something significant to warrant all this media hullabaloo. The threshold, let's see, let's have a look here. It's going to go up from $200 all the way up to $250. Yay! Now look, that's not to disparage what they're doing, because for this change, it does mean about 1.2 million debts are expected to be waived or not even raised in the first place this financial year. And that's great. That really is great. But $200 30 years ago is the equivalent of purchasing power about $460 in 2025 dollars. Or, to put it in the common parlance, about a dozen eggs and a litre of milk. If you happen to already have some flour, maybe you can make yourself a cake to celebrate. No sprinkles though, because that will push you over the budget. So really, they've given us half? Less than half of what we used to get. Like, they're just, like, it looks nice, but if they really wanted to push us up, they'd have to have jumped us up to about $460 in equivalent value. This is like saying, hey, mate, I know you ordered a pizza with extra toppings, but here's the box and some crusts and the memory of a topping. Bon appetit! Income appropriate was the method that was used for decades, but it was ruled unlawful, placing a question mark over more than $1 billion in debt owed by welfare recipients stretching back to the late 1970s. However, the Federal Court's July ruling confirmed the debt has been used to make calculations since 2020 is considered valid. So don't even go thinking there will be more of this forgiveness going around. Certainly not. This is as far as the government budget can stretch the budget for empathy for the foreseeable future. After all, the administrative cost spent on recouping the up to $300 million in accidental debts would have been higher than the value of the sums owed. They've really overspent the budget on this one. The government acknowledged the administrative cost of chasing small debts often cost more than the debt itself, making the process uneconomical. Ah! There it is. There's the truth of the matter. Seems the key to securing empathy in the year of our budget, 2025, is to be economically unviable. Not morality, not justice, not empathy. Just being too fucking expensive to bully poor people anymore. Well, not all poor people, but the really poor people. And here I thought being economically unviable was only for people being denied bank loans. No, no, no. It seems it also is for governments who don't want to deal with your shit anymore. Which means, finally, the poor have achieved equality with big corporations. Well, if not quite equality, at least they're standing on similar ground. You know, they're in like third place compared to big corporations' first place. Because if you're rich, you don't pay taxes because it's too hard. And if you're poor, you might not pay debts because it's too expensive to bully you. We'll have to call that equality for now. You know, we really are the lucky country. This is the dream, right? A united nation. Not by fairness or justice, but by being uneconomical. Smells like victory. Smells like joy. Welcome to Australia, where compassion is means tested and cruelty is fully funded, until the next election at least. Though it brings into question the continued existence of the Liberal Party. As a major political party, they haven't been economically viable for over a decade. The Greens have introduced legislation to impose recommendations outstanding from the Royal Commission, such as big ticket items like reinstating the 6-year limit on recovery of debts, establishing a duty of care for the Department of Social Services that prioritizes the needs of Social Security recipients while administering the law, restricting the kinds of decisions which can be made or automated without human oversight, and better protections for people experiencing hardship from receiving compliance notices. And some of the more fun ones, but don't hold your breath for some of these more fun ones, things like base levels of respect and dignity, raising the level of pay to something livable, reducing call center wait times to less than the gestation period of the average elephant, and payments delivered in actual money instead of whatever expired monopoly money they have sitting around in treasury. But again, these are just the nice to haves. We're not anticipating any movement on any of these. Now, all this being said, the government is also contemplating forgiving up to $1 billion worth of debts instead of letting the Department of Social Services pursue them, despite the court ruling the debts could be recalculated and recouped. They went on to say that if everything goes well, they can use this as an excuse to continue to fail to pursue businesses who extorted the JobKeeper system during COVID. Yeah, Harvey Norman, I haven't forgotten about what you did, you dole-bludging fucker, you cushion-hoarding welfare vampire. They have, however, already decided that pursuing the back taxes of major corporations like Google and News Corp is not economically viable. Which makes sense because apparently in Australia, trickle-down economics actually refers to the government trickling debt notices down onto the unemployed. Because you know their motto, haha, 1 in 3 big corporations are allowed to get away with paying no tax as long as we're relentlessly pursuing the poor. Now, despite their relentless pursuit of stripping the poorest in society of every dollar they possess, you might be surprised to learn that the government will pay a further $475 million to robo-debt victims as part of the class action settlement. This will bring the total amount to $548.5 million, with a total of $60 million set aside to administer the settlement scheme and up to $13.5 million to go to Gordon Legal to cover their legal costs. Now, don't get too excited. Though the settlement is still subject to approval from the federal court, and even though the Attorney General, Michelle Rowland, said settling the claim shows the government is doing the right thing, even if it is approved, because there are so many victims of robo-debt, it'll equate to about roughly $1,000 per person, and that's assuming they don't put restrictions or like tabulations on it that might mean that some people get less in order for other people to get more. So congratulations! After years of harassment, fear, and in some cases actual tragedy, you get a slightly better microwave! If you're lucky. Otherwise, you might get slightly less than that. Yay! I mean, it is better than what they normally get from the government, which is a false apology, a non-promise to do better, a vague commitment about the future, the privilege of being rolled out as the official political cudgel that will be used to beat the opposition with until the next election, or until a bigger, more opportunistic photo opportunity worthy disaster happens as a result of a political party that isn't them. So how fun for us. It's nice to be noticed. But it fundamentally overlooks the one thing that we have wanted from this whole experience. The exposure and punishment of the supervillain group known only as the Robo-Debt Six. Yeah, that shadowy cabal of bureaucratic Bond villains who dreamt up a system where Excel spreadsheets could cosplay as Judge Dredd. Settling the case allows the current government to draw a line under a scandal that plagued its predecessors. And there will be no legal finding on whether public servants knowingly acted unlawfully. They undoubtedly did, but we won't get to know precisely what kind of legal culpability the alleged wrongdoers may have held. We don't get to see them go to court. We don't get to see them dragged before the world and have their name slung through the mud and accused of things that they may or may not have done. They call it justice. The case has one final frontier, I suppose. The Knack is our Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Fuck!
Yeah, the same Knack that was run by Paul Brereton, who failed to make all the necessary steps to fully recuse himself from the decision-making process because of a possible conflict of interest. That Knack, that very same Knack, they're our only hope. Because nothing screams independent integrity watchdog quite like the phrase, "Sorry, can't investigate my mate Dave. We went to the same uni and he still owes me a pint." Because if there's one thing I've learned doing this podcast, it's that justice stops the moment that someone says, "Yeah, but he's my friend." I would happily, as I'm sure many others would, happily give up my share of this settlement to see the names of the RoboDebt 6 from the sealed section that was not made public, and to see them come to proper justice. But they have to come to actual proper justice. To date, no senior public servants have been terminated, let alone convicted over RoboDebt. It's been a fraught process to get to this point, and there's been no public timeframe for the conclusion of its investigation. Its proceedings are only typically held in private to avoid prejudicing any potential future legal action. While the NAC can recommend criminal charges, it cannot prosecute individuals itself. At this point, I'm not giving up the one thing that I'm likely to get from this whole RoboDebt bullshit for no reason. That $1,000, I'll take it. But only because there's a distinct lack of justice flowing in the direction of the government. And given the Knack already dropped the ball once due to the power of undisclosed friendships, I don't want these guys to be the last opportunity that I have for justice. Welcome to the end of the podcast. Thank you so much for hanging around and for listening. I hope you enjoyed yourselves. If you've come this far, I assume you have, or you've fallen asleep. Either way, thank you. If you know anybody who you think would enjoy this type of content, please do send them my way. Share this wherever you can. If you want to support the show, do join the Patreon. I would really appreciate any support that you can give. We have a varying number of levels and of support that you can give. It's patreon.com/Matt Harvey Stuff. Otherwise, look after yourselves out there. Stay safe and goodbye. Thank you.